Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Back Half, the New Statesman's Culture Podcast with me, Tom.
And me, Kate.
And this is a very special episode of The Back Half because it's the last episode of The Back Half.
Hooray!
Wait. I paused for too long. In its present format, Kate. But we, like Theresa May, we fight on.
We fight on. We stagger through. We will no longer be the hindquarters of the pantomime ass. We will, because we're actually getting a bit of a promotion to the main New Statesman podcast, where we'll be appearing monthly from the new year, which is very exciting for us. It's a leg up in the world.
We may slot one in December as well.
Yes.
If we have something exciting to say.
Yeah.
Yes. So if you already subscribe to the main New Statesman podcast, which is hosted by Helen Lewis and Stephen Bush, then carry on as you are. You'll just get an extra dosage of us every month. And if you're not subscribed to that podcast, WTF,
mm-hmm.
Where have you been?
Mm-hmm.
Get on it.
It's got many listeners.
Yeah.
So hopefully we will bring all our listeners from this onto that one and add like a tiny percentage to their overall.
Add four.
But you will be able to hear a variation of this and with items and obviously a non-anniversary as well, because we will never lose our non-anniversary.
No, you can't rip it away from us out of our grasping clutches. Today we will have a non-anniversary. Mm-hmm. It's quite a high quality non-anniversary.
Mm.
You know, sometimes we go low.
Mm-hmm.
This time we've gone sort of medium high.
Mm.
We'll also be talking about a rather extraordinary gig. I say extraordinary because I know Kate detests it when people say extraordinary.
Because they,
you
I
have
think,
a theory, don't
I have
you?
A theory that people, posh people on the radio say extraordinary to give themselves a bit more thinking time and they put an extra syllable in it. It was the most extraordinary film, they say, and then they've used up some more time and then they don't have to make a point. Just listen to people on Front Row in the Today programme saying how extraordinary things.
What's your kind of intensifier of choice? What adjective do you reach for?
Oh gosh, yeah, a short one, I guess. I don't know. What do you do? I would say amazing, but that's
amazing.
Bland,
yeah.
Isn't it? Awesome.
We need to really invent some new ones, actually.
Yeah. I mean, some of them are like, tremendous is good. Anything with three syllables is kind of like it really builds up to it, doesn't it? Monumental.
How do you feel about terrific?
I don't mind terrific.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's use terrific today.
Okay. We'll have a terrific chat about a gig we went to last night. We went to see Christine and the Queens at the Hammersmith Apollo.
Mm-hmm. And we also went to the Royal Academy to see the Klimt and Schiele drawings exhibition. And we are going to bring, right now, our art critic Michael Prodger on to talk about that with us, because he can do it much better than us.
Yes, so we're going to defer to Michael. So we've just been to see Klimt Schiele drawings at the Royal Academy. And we recently ran a piece in the magazine by Michael Prodger, our art critic, who is sitting right here in the studio with us today. Hello, Michael.
Hello there.
So, Michael, what's the idea behind this exhibition? What's the connection between Klimt and Schiele?
The connection is that they were the major artists of the first 10, 20 years of the 20th century in Austria, but also among those in Europe too. And the real link is that Schiele, who was 28 years younger than Klimt, was a big fan and introduced himself to the older artist, to Klimt, in around about 1907, 1908. And apparently there's an apocryphal story that he showed him a load of drawings and Sheila asked Klimt, do they show talent? And Klimt responded, yes, too much. but nevertheless, these two artists of a completely different generation, at different stages of their career. Klimt, by this point, was a very established artist, fated, a little bit notorious at the same time. Klimt was just, Sheila was just starting out, became sort of friends, and Sheila looked at Klimt as a sort of mentor. And they kept up a certain relationship for the remainders of their life, which in fact wasn't very long, since they both died in 1918, which is the point of bringing this the two of them together at this point in time to Royal Academy.
Sheila already knew he was good. You make the point in your piece that he wrote to his mother, reminding her that she should be grateful for having given birth to a genius.
Yeah, he wasn't lacking in self-confidence, nor, of course, was Klimt. He had this a career that took him from fame to notoriety, back to fame. And he spent the last chunk of his life largely keeping him to himself, being economically viable, looking after his father's family when his father died young, and his brother's family when his brother died young. And to do this, he painted society women, and his golden paintings, his famous golden paintings, which he charged a great deal of money for. And he wasn't averse to rumours going around that he was sleeping with every woman who came into his studio. But in fact, he was, although he was married, he had a long relationship with a fashion designer called Emily Flöger, and seems to have been relatively sort of faithful to her, or if not faithful, at least discreet. And he didn't attract notoriety and infamy in the way that Sheila was to do. So there was a strange thing that they were both outsider artists, avant-gardists. But in terms of respectability, Klimt was the more respectable of the two men.
Although you do say that Klimt used to wear nothing under his kaftan while working.
Yeah, well, I don't quite know how this came about. I mean, everybody repeats this, so I felt it was my duty to do the same.
It's my favourite part of the piece.
But he had this kaftan that was supposedly designed by Emily, and he floated around in this sort of pasha kind
of way.
There's
a photograph, isn't there, at the beginning of the exhibition of him in this...
With this amazing beard and sort of, on profile.
No, he liked this sort of Old Testament prophet, calm. Yeah. Oriental potentate, which fits in with the sort of this glitter and gold, the Byzantine aspect.
And Sheila took on the kaftan as well, didn't he?
He had a kaftan phase. Yes, he went through a kaftan phase.
Although when you look at the photographs of the two of them that begin in the very first room of the exhibition, you can see that they're different generations, can't you? Because Sheila might have adopted the kaftan, but he sort of weirdly looks like a kind of David Lynch figure or something. He's quite sharp. He's wearing quite a sharp suit, quite a cool sort of modern haircut. And Klimt has this sort of weird, sort of almost like Rasputin-like demeanor. Yeah.
I think that's right. I think, again, that fits with the pictures that both of them produced, in the sense that Klimt's work was largely set out of time. So when he was drawing women, and it tended to be women, he made them into archetypes. Mythical figures, the personifications of sort of abstract, whether it was humanity or virtue or whatever it happened to be, whereas Klimt painted real people and they stayed as real people.
Sheila painted.
I beg your pardon, yeah. Sheila did.
It's very weirdly, even though their names sound very dissimilar, I find I cannot talk about them without mixing
without
them up.
Without hesitating and thinking, have I got the right one? Yeah.
Well, thank you for pointing out my mistake.
I was wondering when I was looking around at the Klimt sketches, and often, have sort of quite a detailed head falling into a sort of geometric body, a kind of clothed, almost like a kaftan wearing body. I wondered how much he influenced kind of Art Nouveau, or how much he was influenced by it. Was there a kind of a close tie-in between those sorts of images?
There was that whole thing about the Vienna Secession and Jugendstil, with the young style, and Art Nouveau. Art Nouveau really slightly preceded them, and these slightly Germanic forms with the Vienna Secession followed on and took them on into this world of stylization and design. Very graphic, very visual, if that's not tautological. But they did grow out of that stylized form of Art Nouveau, but took it into this sort of glittery world that that Art Nouveau never quite entered. Took away the sort of floral forms and plant-based imagery of and curves in many ways.
And what was the idea behind the secession movement, which Klimt was very instrumental in, wasn't he?
He was one of the founders in 1897, and the idea was really not to give a prescribed form of what art should be, whether it should be realist or abstract or historical, whatever, but to take it away from the way that art was taught in Vienna at the time, which was quite formal and historicist. So it was really a place for young, innovative artists to show their work and to be among their peers.
And did it have an afterlife? Because movements tend to sort of flare up and burn out quite quickly. This one looked like it had a bit of a kind of coherent thought behind it, in that you've got a sort of very beautiful looking journal, Versacrum,
Sacred Spring,
and exhibitions and a kind of a bit of a coherent ideology behind it.
It was. I mean, it didn't last forever. Indeed, Klimt, who was one of the founders, seceded from the secession himself because they had a philosophical falling out about what art should be. Though it did put on a lot of exhibitions in a sort of 10-year period. The war, as the war did with virtually all art, it tore up what had gone before and remade it afterwards. So, but its great flowering between 1897 and up to around about 1908, 1910, was very influential, and it brought together not just Austrian artists, but it was a place for contemporary art from the rest of Europe to be seen by the Austrian public. And at least initially, the Austrian government was quite pro and gave them the space to build the Secession Building, which is still there in the middle of Vienna.
When you were going around this show, I mean, could you help but question who was the better drawer?
It just seemed to me that you came away that this in this particular bit of arm wrestling, there was only one winner, and it's Sheila's pictures.
Why is that?
They are so distinctive. And I think it stems from the fact that they drew for slightly different reasons, that Klimt drew largely in a preparatory way for his paintings. Sheila very, very rarely did that. He drew as a form of artistic Tourette's because he couldn't help himself drawing. And he had a style that is absolutely distinctive. Klimt's drawings tend to be quite elegant often, even when they're genuinely sketchy sketches. But there's an angularity and a knobbliness and a very distinctive personality to Sheila's drawings that sort of sears itself. I'm sorry, but it does on the visual memory. And there's all these debates about his women being pornographic. I think if you look at pornography, I think you could define it as something that is supposed to titillate a viewer. I don't think these are in any way pornographic.
No, they're not, yeah.
I mean, they may be rude and explicit, but I don't think they're pornographic.
No, they're both heavily into Freud, you make the point. They'd read the essays, the sexuality essays from, 1906? Yeah.
I mean, Freud was just around the corner. I mean, Vienna's not a huge city. It's a very compact place, and Freud was living and working half a mile away from them. And I don't think in the atmosphere of the time they could have been unaware. And there was certainly a group there's two very explicit Klimt drawings of a woman masturbating that were done for a collection of erotic pictures and prose for a group of collectors. And you've got artists who are buying into this, you've got collectors who are buying into this, and you've got Freud who's giving it a theoretical imprint, all in the same place at the same time. It seems too much of a coincidence to be a coincidence.
Were the erotic drawings actually displayed to the public, or was there an area, were they an area of their work that had to be kind of kept a bit quiet? You
know? It was a bit of both. They weren't displayed as such, though. Klimt got into trouble because the nudes he did for the University of Vienna were thought unseemly. In fact, they're quite decorous by modern standards. They were all lost at the end of the Second World War when the retreating Nazis blew up a castle in which they were currently held. So they,
but that commission was cancelled, right?
That commission was cancelled, but he did do the paintings.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They were for show. The drawings, which tend to be far more explicit, were for connoisseurs, if you can call them that, private collections, as they always have been during the history of art. The rude stuff goes, you know, is for the back room and private delectation.
You mentioned in the piece, you tell the story of a point in Schiele's life where it's quite traumatic for him, where he is arrested for housing a girl who's run away, and he helps her kind of go and find her grandmother, but effectively she's run away from her parents. And this is discussed in the exhibition, and they have show the drawings that he did in prison. But actually the thing that he was eventually sort of convicted for was for failing to keep erotic nudes in a sufficiently safe space. So it was the fact that this young girl would be in his house, and she might see
them.
Corrupting things, which is fascinating in a way, because then one of the most sort of genuinely challenging pictures in the show is a Schiele nude of a very young girl, isn't it?
Yeah, and as the curators point out, the age of consent at the time was 14. So it's far, you know, it's that in itself is a shock. But it means that legally he wasn't necessarily transgressing any bounds. Morally is a different question. I mean, it's a very uncomfortable picture, the one you're talking about. It's painted in grey for a start. So you've got sex and death in one painting. It's putrescence and eroticism. And he is absolutely explicit that this is about sex. You know, it's because he uses a vivid pink watercolour in only three places, which are lips, nipples and labia. And, you know, that seems to me, it's bang, bang, bang. It's the three places of interest for him. So I think there's no mistaking whatever he thought he was doing, that this is a painting about sex and sex and a very young girl.
Mm. Mm. So he was living then with his partner in a village, and the young girl was staying with them. And what actually did happen?
She wasn't staying with them. They had moved out. Schiele was a big nature fan, slightly, as indeed was Klimt. The two things that interested Klimt were women and largely trees and landscape. Mm. They were the only two things that really interested him. and there, it's a shame that there's no room in the exhibition for any of Klimt's landscapes, because they're really spectacular things. But Schiele was sort of similar in that he was very interested in landscape. So they had moved out of Vienna with his lover, Walli Neuzel, who had been introduced to him by Klimt. And they were living in a little village called Krumau, which is 30 miles outside Vienna. And had obviously what passed in Vienna, the sort of living habits that were okay in Vienna were not okay in this little rural outpost. So they were already figures of some interest and disapproval there. And the local children would come round and sort of look at what these two curiosities were up to and go into the studio, hence they would have seen these pictures. Mm. And a girl who was the daughter, I think, of a retired naval captain, fell out with her parents, wanted to go to Vienna to stay with her grandmother, who was there, and asked Klimt and Walli to take her there, which they did. And they were pulled up for child abduction and seduction.
Mm.
He spent 24 days in jail, but was let out when it was clear that there was no case to answer there. But the judge clearly disapproved of his art, because he burned one of Schiele's drawings in the courtroom just to show what he thought of this degenerate stuff. And he was convicted of immorality for, as you say, for allowing illicit pictures to be seen by minors.
Yeah.
You say that they were sort of friends, Klimt and Schiele. What was the relationship between them, and how much of a mentor was Klimt, really?
He never taught Schiele. They had these exchanges of drawings. So it was a professional courtesy. I don't think they spent very much time together, though they kept up they met semi-regularly. And it was acknowledged, I think, by Schiele that Klimt was the senior artist. Klimt, Schiele, as we've said, wasn't lacking in self-belief, but he realised that this was the senior man. And indeed, he wanted to take over that sort of portrait practice that Klimt had, and to become as successful as the older artist, though he never managed it. At the end of their lives, Klimt was still charging 20 or 30 times more than than Schiele could charge.
There was one bit in the exhibition where they said that Schiele, I don't know whether this was Schiele or someone on behalf, but sort of tried to bill himself as the Silver Klimt.
Yes, I think that was going to be a failure. The aesthetics were completely different in many ways.
And the posh ladies are going to want to commission Klimt rather than Schiele in a nice dress, aren't they?
Exactly. Yes.
madam, you can have yourself in this beautiful gold leaf flowing dress. Or we can just chop your legs off at the knees,
yeah.
Show your fanny, and cut your head off.
Over to you. But he was, nevertheless, I think there are quite a lot of women that did, a little bit of them rather liked that idea. And in the last year, the curators at the show point out that he had 177 different sittings of people coming to sit for him. Yeah. How many of those were him asking people to sit for him so he could carry on drawing, and how many were coming because they wanted to be drawn by Sheila is not so clear. But he was getting there at the time that he died, and he died at 28. You know,
yeah,
what would he have done at that point? He was already, I think, one of the greatest draftsmen in the history of art, bar none.
Mm.
If he had lived another 30 years, who knows?
And he drew Klimt in the morgue after Klimt died. Have you seen those pictures?
No, I haven't.
So they still exist?
They still exist. He's not the only one. I think it's Don Bacardi did these drawings of Isherwood after Isherwood had died. They're, you know, some deeply creepy
like
things going
mask,
on.
Like a death mask, isn't it?
Like a death mask, yeah, yeah.
And it was the Spanish
influenza
epidemic that wiped them both out in 1918.
Yeah, I'm not so sure. It certainly got Sheila. It got his wife Edith, just a matter of days beforehand, who at that point was 6 months pregnant. And Volley had gone off to the front at this point to serve in the Red Cross, and she died in Croatia, I think, of scarlet fever. And Klimt died at the beginning of 1918 from, I think it's probably pneumonia as complications from the influenza epidemic.
Imagine having to contend with that now, like if our great cultural figures were just taken out by the flu and you just lost them to pandemics.
It just seems that horrible thing that after the war had taken out so many artists and so many poets, then comes along this something that's even worse and takes out a load of the remainers and some of the best ones too.
Well, Klimt Sheila Drawings is at the Royal Academy until the 3rd of February. Thanks very much, Michael.
Thank you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So, Kate, last night we were in the circle of the Eventim Apollo.
Mm.
Not the Hammersmith Apollo, but the Eventim Apollo. I always thought it was like the Carling Apollo or something.
Changes.
But they change.
It changes.
They keep
a lot.
Changing. But good on Eventim for stumping up the cash for that.
Yeah.
And we went to see the tiny French singer Christine and the Queens.
Yes, like Florence and her machine.
Yeah.
It's a kind of a catch-all for a sort of a concept of an alter ego of a woman called Héloïse Letissier, who is still very young. I don't know how young she is, 20s. And she is the daughter of two, I think, English teachers in Paris. So she has this amazing, rather posh, clipped French-English kind of way of talking. So she's like, this is the second night I've done in that venue, she says on stage. It's like, so she'll get the odd word wrong, but she sounds amazing at the same time. So she had a kind of theatre arts background, as far as I recall, and
you interviewed her
interviewed
a couple of years back, didn't you?
For us,
she had a sort of her breakthrough was a couple of years back. She had a kind of a Glastonbury performance, a Jules Holland performance, and a single kind of that all came out within a few months.
Yes, so. The single Tilted, and she was put on Graham Norton, right. Which was quite a big thing because she's had this sort of very distinct. She was wearing a grey suit and little sneakers, and she was doing this Michael Jackson style dancing and this extremely light lightness of touch, kind of bubbly French pop song with English words, and everybody just like, oh, who the hell's this kind of thing. So I think it just rocketed it into the top 20 or something. But she had a kind of epiphany when she was 19 or 20, where she was at the end of a relationship and she came over to London and she had a night out in the sadly now defunct Madame Jojo's. I mean, tragically now defunct Madame Jojo's, whereby she'd kind of walked around, got talking to a load of drag queens, probably got drunk, was taken home by them, had a bit of a meltdown in front of them, and was given a sort of basically a big kick up the ass by these drag queens, a pep talk, talking about how she could express herself and find greater freedom of expression and use sadness to, in a theatrical sense, put it onto the outside. And it kind of created this this concept of this alter ego called Christine, who's now delicately evolving and her second record, which is, I think, we both agree, far better than her first one.
Yeah.
She's on stage and she's going, well, you know, I had my first record, and now that Chris is still around, a bit more defiant and muscly and sweaty, but still the same obsessions. That's how she talks.
She's now Chris.
She's now Chris.
She was Christine in the Queens and for the first record, and in the second one, she's remodeled herself as Chris, which is kind of drawing out the masculine stuff which was present in the first one, certainly in the performances, and like really pushing that to the fore. So it's kind of all about harnessing a sort of slightly more aggressive, in your face sexuality. But the songwriting is great, right? Like, so it's kind of bits of Prince, bits of Michael Jackson, bits of Kate Bush. I mean, I don't know what else is in there. It's just, you know, and
it's sort of like, 80s melodies that kind of get you in the gut.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And they're sort of sad but colourful at the same time. Yeah. It's just got this sort of rather exhilarating feel about it. But it was so interesting seeing her because it was like a theatre performance, wasn't it? It was like, I mean, you'd seen Kate Bush on that stage doing her sort of semi-theatrical thing. And you made a comment to me that actually you thought this was more successful than that.
I thought this was more exciting. Yeah, I mean, the it's interesting, like, how do you incorporate elements of theatre into a stage show? And I realised that actually, really, most of the bands I see just don't at all. They're just, you know, doing their thing. And, you know, I tend not to go and see the sort of Justin Timberlakes and Lady Gagas and stuff who do actually kind of put on big theatrical arena tours. But to come back to Kate Bush, it was wonderful, but it was a big Baroque, like, to be honest, slightly overbaked, you know, narrative that she's woven her songs into. You know, she tried to turn it into kind of something more operatic. And what I loved about Christine and the Queen's performance was that it was, you know, it basically used the elements that we had in like our like GCSE drama lessons. Like, it was a black box stage, like a couple of rostra. Our drama teacher was always going on about stacking the rostra. You haven't stacked the rostra properly.
What's the point of the rostra?
The rostra are just those like little platforms that the band are sitting on. But like they're like the most versatile parts of like stage furniture, whatever, because you can stack them up, you can make higher levels, you can make lower levels, whatever. So the band are standing on these, the band's just like four dudes, right?
Yeah.
And they're standing each on individual rostra, which are then like moved around throughout the performance. And she has this amazing set of, what's a half a dozen dancers who are dressed like a kind of slight update of something out of West Side Story. You know, they're kind of like cut off, you know, they look quite 80s in a way.
They're street kids. They're 80s.
Street kids, exactly.
Essentially just promenading behind one another in the way it, like you would do in GCSE drama. And then she, so it's like they're in a playground or something. And
yeah.
Then, hey, Chris arrives. And yeah. She comes on. It's very, it's almost like naive.
Yes, absolutely.
But very effective because she enacts these little psychodramas on stage in a very, again, with this sort of unheavy-handed approach. There's a song called I'm a Man Now on the first album. And it's sort of she, you know, her talking to a male dancer and the kind of sense of the shifting energies of female and male between them. But it's a lot of kind of like, you know, throwing your fingers in someone's face and making a shrugging gesture and stalking off for a minute and coming back. And it's very lively. But yeah, it's not sort of supposedly knitted together into some coherent theatrical narrative as far as I can see.
No, but what it does do is it teases out the little mini narratives in the songs and like
the emotional narratives.
Yeah, the emotional narratives in the songs. And I find listening to her songs really interesting because I think the lyrics are probably quite good, but I've listened to that record a lot and I'm only just beginning to hear them because although for a start, she records two versions of all her albums. So there's an English version and a French version. I think she probably does the English version first and then sort of retranslates it into French. But because of her intonation and the way she sings, often you're none the wiser as to what she's actually talking about. But you get a bit of the emotional feel of it, and then what she's done with the dance is sort of bring it out. So if it is about, you know, she's got this song Girlfriend, like I Don't Feel Like a Girlfriend, and the dance then, you know, picks up on that theme, and she pushes forward a kind of masculine character who's rebelling against the idea of like being someone's other half, and it's brilliantly done throughout the whole show, really. And I love the way that the dancers, I mean, it is very much, I'm going to keep banging on about West Side. In some ways I feel like this whole evening was precision tooled for my pleasure, like as someone who grew up obsessed with both West Side Story and the music and dancing of Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
Like it could not be better.
She did a little bit of Man in the Mirror, didn't she?
Oh, she sung one line of Man in the Mirror and I was like, I reached for the handkerchief. But it is that, it's that, I mean, Michael Jackson drew on West Side Story as well for like things like Bad and Beat It and stuff. But it's absolutely that school of choreography, like using a bit of aggression and a bit of movement. And she you know, as you say, they're like running around the stage. So it's brilliantly done so that there'll be complete like kind of loose motley crew, and then suddenly on a break they'll kick into synchronized movement, which I always think is like, it's probably the most basic trick, but I always find that
so
really
satisfying.
Effective,
yeah,
and satisfying because
they're
just random people on stage and suddenly bam, they're doing a great dance.
You can see it working in a bigger venue. I mean, it was like packed out for two nights and she's really sort of taken off and stuff. But one thing I hope that she never changes is this extremely uncool stage patter that she has. It's the sweetest thing in the world. She'll be like, questions, why are you doing this? I have no idea, that kind of thing. And there was one point towards the end when I wrote down what she said because it was so bizarre. She goes, I don't want it to stop. Ha ha. You're stuck with me all night. But the healthy way is I have to let you go. Have experiences of your own and come back. And then she's like, she ran from stage up to the upper circle. She performed a song in her bra, draping herself over the top of the balcony. And she was obviously really enjoying that bit. And then she took the mic and she ran down back through the bar. And as she did so, she narrated what she saw. She was running. So she went, cardio. People singing at the bar, people leaving, they should probably stay. She saw people leaving her own gig and she was just like narrating it. But also that you can feel that, I mean, she's probably got some amazing choreographer, but you can feel that sort of bubbly creativity coming into the set, because you can imagine at one point she goes, why don't we have a forest at night with snow? I don't know why. And that's exactly what you got for a couple of the really anthemic songs, this beautiful backdrop with this sort of spectral trees and then this artificial snow falling down and then sand at one point falling out of the ceiling and no explanation as to why.
No, but really effective. But I suppose that maybe that contradicts my earlier point about it being minimalist, but those were two very, very well chosen, like little bits of kind of artifice.
And towards the end, that was the sort of climax, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And she's gloriously uncool in a way. Like, I think you were saying yesterday, you know, she could have made this show a lot cooler. So this character of Chris, you know, if you cut out the stage patter and like beefed up the kind of aggressive sexual nature of it, you know, it could be a very different kind of thing. But actually, she's just really enjoying mucking about with all this. And also her ideas of like gender and gender fluidity, you know, that could have gone in a much more serious sort of po-faced direction, but she's kept it kind of energetic and celebratory, even for the sad songs.
And she does have her own story there in that sense. I mean, she would have been, I think she was in a relationship with a girl, was the big one when she came over and did her Madame Jojo's thing. So she was obviously out from a teenager, but then is obviously questioning how male, how masculine her identity is and stuff. So she's sort of pushing that a lot. But she could really go a lot more heavy-handed on that stuff. But I think it kind of works in terms of an inclusive pop culture experience, and it does have a bit of a root in the old Lady Gaga kind of, you know, My Little Monsters, this is a safe space type thing. Yeah. So you can see that. And I love that sort of sense of it not being too prescriptive in one way or another. I mean, the audience was like hugely mixed. There were loads of people in their 50s and 60s there.
The guy next to me was like, he must have been in his late 60s, and he like turned to me over, "She's terrific, isn't she? I saw her 2 years ago at the Roundhouse." This American guy was like, "Great." And then there were like, you know, very sort of gender fluid looking 13-year-olds there as well. Like, so you're right. It kind of really, but also that's the kind of the dancing and the sort of entertainment aspect of it has a very broad appeal, I think. Yeah, you kind of think, why don't more people do this?
I just hope she continues the chat and doesn't end up with the headset microphone and a kind of glacial exterior. I want her to remain like this kind of weird drama teacher.
Well, yeah, I know, there is a danger of that, isn't there? And you know, I was reading that Madonna's sort of tried to befriend her and kind of get her on board. And I think there's only one person gaining from that relationship, and it's Madonna,
really, yeah.
Because Christine she doesn't need that. In a way, that's the risk, that she gets adopted by, you know, I don't know, Madonna and Ariana Grande and,
Janelle
Monáe, and like becomes part of some kind of like little mutual appreciation society. She needs to keep it real.
Keep it real.
Keep it real.
I have in my notes here that it's 16 years to the week since Eminem's 8 Miles was released to the cinema. So I should go back to my desk and do some subbing on my own notes. But yeah, so Eminem's great autobiographical film, 8 Miles, hit the screens 16 years ago. Did you see this film?
I did see this film. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I think at the time, I wasn't interested in Eminem, really. Weirdly, I kind of got into Eminem a bit after seeing the film, I think.
Really?
I kind of just slightly dismissed him, but I mean, it's a brilliant biopic, isn't it? And the thing which you probably should avoid doing, because the egotism of it is staggering and can only lead to bad things, i.e. play yourself in a film about your own life. I mean, you know, that's disastrous, isn't it? But somehow he gets away with it.
I think he pulls it off because he does, I was just thinking of comparisons, but Moby's great biography, I think he's done two now, but the first one of those, it stopped at the point at which he got famous. So this is about the struggle. This is about Eminem's, like Eminem and his mum and his crappy life. And that works.
So they're living on a trailer park, aren't they?
And
has he got a kid at this stage or not? I can't remember. I think maybe he's got this girlfriend that he's struggling with. He's trying to sort of make it as a rapper, but he's doing some kind of manual labor as well at the same time.
Yeah, so it cuts off. It's not unegotistical at all, but it cuts off at the point where it becomes. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about, as a massive comparison, the critic-proof Bohemian Rhapsody, the Queen film, and just that sense that in terms of, like, the only struggle that you get in films like that is the obligatory line that goes like, "Well, how are we going to get our records on the radio now?" That kind of thing. You know, that's the way that they do fame, instead of looking at the actual kind of biography of the neighborhood and the schooling and the kind of the teenage years of the act. And I think it's a bit like with Walk the Line, the great Joaquin Phoenix, Johnny Cash film, is that you saw so much of the Arkansas childhood and the sharecropping and the brother getting killed and stuff like that, that you just get more weight behind the character. So you almost can forget that it's a real person, and it's just dramatically very effective. It also recalls a time for me where I was in the first or second year of university at this point, and it was very influential for us, because like we used to go around in these massive trousers and we would go to Scala and we watched like Ludacris battling with people and stuff like that, and we kind of felt we were in these films, because there was a spate of them at the beginning of the 2000s that had like real rap battles in them, and you'd go into
ever taken part in a rap battle?
No, but we would also like they would happen and you'd like clear the floor. It was kind of amazing that this went on for a little short period, and it was reflected in films, in all the dance movies like Save the Last Dance and stuff, where you'd get this kind of posh white girl going into a hip-hop club in Chicago and like taking part in a battle. So we kind of fantasized that we were in 8 Mile ourselves when we were actually at UCL.
It's it does that brilliantly though. It's like the rap battles in it are exhilarating, and I think that's the thing, you have to get that right in a music biopic, don't you? Like I think Walk the Line does that as well. The music scenes in Walk the Line, it opens with the San Quentin prison performance, and it's really kind of the sound is like hits you in the gut. It's really thrilling. And it's done brilliantly in 8 Mile.
Yeah, it's like the non-commercial music moments. It doesn't open with them at like playing to thousands at a paid gig or something.
Yeah.
It's the kind of like, this is where it came from sort of thing. I shall be watching it again this weekend.
Yeah, I've seen it. I've seen it a couple of times, I think, actually. And the main track is brilliant, isn't it? Lose Yourself.
There, 8 Miles by Eminem.
Oh, I forgot to say also, it's the 8th best music biopic of all time, according to Rolling Stone.
Oh.
8th.
Eighth, that's not, oh God.
Is that good or bad? I don't know.
I mean,
the Doors,
go on, go on.
Quickly, I'm Not There is number one.
Gosh.
That's the Bob Dylan, strange Bob Dylan one. Bird, directed by by Clint Eastwood, is it number two?
No, what's that
And then
about?
A John Carpenter TV movie biopic of Elvis, is it number three?
What's Bird?
It's, which jazz musician was nicknamed Bird? Is it Charlie Parker? It's like a impressionistic.
Oh, so they've chosen really arty ones.
Yeah.
For the top three. That's just annoying. Yeah. Where was Walk the Line on that list?
I think it was in the top 10, Walk the Line. Yeah. Dear Rolling Stone, I am very unhappy with your top 10 music biopics of all time that you published
Such
5 years ago.
Pretentious choices. Anyway.
But yes, 8 Mile, it's worth revisiting. Thank you for downloading this episode of The Back Half. If you joined us halfway through The Back Half, I suppose you don't really do that with podcasts. You don't really join them halfway through.
No, unless you take your
headphones
off. You might
have stopped listening at some point.
You go for a wee.
You might have stopped listening for a long period in the middle. This is the last episode in this format.
It's the last half of the half.
The last half of the half. But we are returning on the main New Statesman podcast, hosted by Helen Lewis and Stephen Bush. Me and Kate will have a guest slot on that once a month. I think we're probably going to start in the week of the 17th of December. In the meantime, thank you very much for subscribing and downloading and listening to this podcast. You've been great. And thanks also to Caroline Crampton, who's edited and produced us brilliantly over the...
Gosh, how long have we been going?
2 years.
2 years?
18 months?
2 years. Maybe it's, I think, no, it was September last year, I'm sure.
Right, okay, maybe a little bit over a year. Who knows?
Feels like longer.
Decades. But yes, we'll be back. We'll be back with our new guest slot in December. So do subscribe to the Main New Statesman podcast if you don't already. And Kate, this might be the last time you get to...
It might be the last time for the hard-gigging quintet, quartet. I'm not sure what they are or who they are. But they live in Japan and they're brilliant. And they wrote a fantastic song called Godspeed, which we play every 2 weeks with great joy, and we thank Pistol Jazz.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.